Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Massachusetts Apportionment Update. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, you may press the star followed by the zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, August 21st, 2013. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Michael Jacobs from Reed Smith. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks. Good morning and good afternoon. Welcome to the Reed Smith Massachusetts Apportionment Update Teleseminar. I am Michael Jacobs, a partner in Reed Smith's State Tax Group. I have over 15 years of experience in Massachusetts tax matters, and before joining Reed Smith, I was a partner in a Boston law firm. With me today is Rob Wayman, an associate in our State Tax Group. Rob keeps our clients up to date with regular updates on what's new in the Massachusetts tax world. For today's teleseminar, we'll first focus on cases involving Massachusetts cost of performance sourcing rule that are pending at the Appellate Tax Board or have recently been resolved. We'll point out some of the inconsistencies in the positions the department has been taking in those cases and discuss some of the opportunities that remain for taxpayers in the cost of performance area. After that, we'll focus on the market-based sourcing rules that were enacted in July. We'll also talk about the new throwout rule, including some issues regarding how the rule should be applied and the expected constitutional challenges. The teleseminar should run about 25 minutes. We won't be able to take questions during the presentation, but feel free to email us questions using the contact information on the slides. We will get back to you with responses after the teleseminar. Now I'm going to turn things over to Rob, who will discuss some of the cost of performance cases pending in Massachusetts.
Thanks, Mike. As Mike indicated, the next few slides will cover pending cost of performance cases. Since cost of performance is the rule through 2013 for many types of sales other than sales of tangible personal property, these cases will still be relevant for the current tax year and for refund claims and audit offsets for prior periods. Now the fact that there is any cost of performance litigation in Massachusetts can be a bit surprising, since Massachusetts appellate courts have issued decisions in three cases with very different sets of facts: Boston Bruins, involving receipts from operating a hockey franchise; Interface, involving receipts from a travel agency business; and AT&T, involving receipts from operating a national telephone company. In each of those cases, the courts applied the same operational approach to cost of performance. So one would think the taxpayer's entitlement to the operational approach would be certain. Instead, there are over a dozen pending cases on cost of performance at the Appellate Tax Board today. So what gives? Well, speaking earlier this summer, Dave Davenport, who is the Deputy Commissioner and Senior Policy Counsel for the Department of Revenue, stated that he viewed the AT&T decision as one of limited applicability to taxpayers with AT&T's facts. And the department confirmed that this was its own position in a technical information release issued yesterday. So taxpayers that are entitled to use cost performance sourcing, but who are not in the same or a very similar industry to those where there is a decided court case, often find that in the department's view, the prior cases have little or no weight. Now I'll step back for just a moment to refresh the Massachusetts rule. When determining whether a sale, other than a sale of tangible personal property, is included in the sales factor numerator, a taxpayer looks to whether more of the income-producing activity necessary to generate the sales were incurred in Massachusetts than in any other state. This is determined by looking at the taxpayer's costs of performing its income-producing activity. Now, there are exceptions to this rule for specific industries such as telecommunications and utilities, where the department has promulgated special apportionment regulations, and there are also specific regulatory exceptions for certain types of receipts such as royalties. But these exceptions aside, the approach that Massachusetts courts have adopted so far when applying cost of performance sourcing is an operational approach. This approach looks at the taxpayer's income-producing activity as a whole and applies that analysis to all sales related to that income-producing activity. So, for example, in AT&T, the taxpayer's income-producing activity was the provision of a national integrated telecommunications network. looking at its operations as a whole, more of AT&T's costs related to that income-producing activity were incurred in New Jersey, so its sales from that income-producing activity were all sourced to New Jersey and excluded from the Massachusetts sales factor numerator. The department has typically been applying a transactional approach, though we will get into some pending cases where the department is taking the operational approach as well. When the department takes the transactional approach, typically argues that it should be able to thin slice a taxpayer's income-producing activity, focusing in on individual transactions. So in AT&T, the department attempted to look at the sale to each customer individually and source each sale based on the cost of performance related to that particular sale. Now in AT&T, even if you had looked at its sales to each Massachusetts customer on a transaction-by-transaction basis, there was still a good chance that more of AT&T's own costs related to its sales were still incurred in New Jersey, where the primary costs to operate its network were incurred. However, the department tried to add in additional costs, AT&T's access fees paid to third-party local exchange carriers who delivered the final transmissions to customers. The court in AT&T rejected both the application of the transactional approach to AT&T and the inclusion of third-party costs in the cost performance analysis. This makes sense since the department's own regulation bars the inclusion of third-party receipts in the cost performance analysis. Despite this decision, and Boston Bruins and Interface before it, the department continues to hang its hat on language in the AT&T decision and in Interface as well, indicating that there may be some cases where the transactional approach is appropriate. And it's our experience that even in spite of AT&T, the department continues in some cases to attempt to bring third-party costs into its cost and performance analysis. With that background, let's take a look at some operational approach appeals that are currently pending at the Appellate Tax Board. Cases with hearings scheduled in the near future include a case involving a restaurant franchisor arguing that its payments from Massachusetts franchisees should be sourced to its headquarters outside of Massachusetts because its income-producing activity is operating a national and international restaurant franchise. There are several cases involving the sourcing of receipts of broker-dealers with hearings currently scheduled for September. For example, a brokerage firm is arguing that all of its revenue streams, such as customer commissions on brokerage transactions, should be sourced to its New York headquarters. A consulting company is arguing that its income-producing activity is the provision of a national consulting firm capable of handling matters in any jurisdiction, so all sales should be sourced on an operational basis rather than looking at its cost performance for each discrete customer engagement. A money transfer company is arguing that it is entitled to apply the operational approach for its entire money transfer business, sourcing all sales outside of Massachusetts because its sole income-producing activity is the provision of an international money transfer service. That is, its ability to generate any particular sale in any particular location is dependent on its ability to transfer wire money to national and international locations throughout its network. Finally, there's a case pending at the Appellate Tax Board involving wholesaler credits. We view this appeal as a great example of how broadly the operational approach can be applied, so I'll spend a little more time here. The taxpayer is a retailer that sells products at retail stores around the country. Its vendors provide credits to the retailer if it performs a variety of what the taxpayer in its appeal terms as services. These services include placing vendor products in advertising circulars, placing products in preferred positions at its stores, and meeting certain sales targets. The vendor does not include these credits in its line one receipts for federal tax purposes, but instead backs them out of its cost of goods sold. Now, the vendor is arguing that these credits are payments for the performance of one income-producing activity. That activity is the offering of a national sales platform with retail stores and advertising throughout the country. If they did not have this national platform, they would not receive the same credit payments from their vendors. Thus, the taxpayer is arguing that these credits constitute sales to be included in its sales factor numerator, and that all those sales are from one income-producing activity and should be sourced entirely to its home state, where it incurs the greatest costs of maintaining its national retail network. This case should be watched closely not only by retailers, since these credits are common in the industry, but also by taxpayers in all industries, as a taxpayer victory in litigation would make it hard for the department to apply a transactional approach to many different fact patterns. Of course, not every cost of performance appeal actually litigates. The next slide lists some fact patterns that have recently been resolved without litigation. These include sourcing of advertising fees, purchases and sales of natural gas contracts, delivery services that were not covered by the special apportionment provisions covering package delivery companies, as well as information services providers. Now, in each pending or resolved case I've described, the department has been applying a transactional approach to the taxpayer's facts, while the taxpayer is applying an operational approach. What's interesting is that the department is actually taking the exact opposite position in other pending litigation. I'll mention two cases. The first involves a gift card management entity. This entity manages gift cards for a variety of affiliated retailers and is located in Massachusetts. In this case, it's the taxpayer arguing that it should source its receipts on a transactional basis and also that it should be allowed to bring in out-of-state third-party costs. Massachusetts, on the other hand, is arguing that the company has one income-producing activity and that an operational approach must be applied to source all of its receipts to Massachusetts. Taxpayers that perform gift card management or similar services and would benefit from the department's method should consider refund claims if they have not already applied the operational approach to their sales. Another interesting appeal involves a company that develops, licenses, and then maintains software for affiliate retail entities. The company develops the software and then licenses it to its affiliates, and it charges a licensing fee. The license fee is for the software as well as maintenance services provided by employees, majority of whom are located in Massachusetts. The taxpayer treated these payments as sales of software licenses and sourced the license following Massachusetts rules for sales of tangible personal property. The department, however, classified the entire license as a service and sourced the service to the taxpayer's Massachusetts location where the majority of its employees managing the software were located. The department's position in this appeal is a particularly aggressive application of the operational approach, and for out-of-state companies that make similar sales but would benefit from using cost performance, the department's position is certainly one to consider. And this leads to my final topic, how to position your cost performance appeal. We look at both the wholesaler credit appeal and the department's position applying cost of performance sourcing to receipts typically viewed as software sales of software licenses as great lessons for other taxpayers. The lesson is think expansively about the cost of performance rule in Massachusetts. Can you classify what you're selling as a service, even though it's typically considered a sale of TPP? And if so, can you argue that your costs are incurred, to a larger extent outside of Massachusetts than in Massachusetts? And even if it's not a position that you would take on a return or in a refund claim, these positions can serve as offsets at audit or be additional issues that provide value to your assessment challenge, to any assessment challenge. Second lesson is that the department is taking contrary positions on cost of performance. So no matter what approach benefits you, whether it's operational or transactional, there may be petitions, briefs, and other materials that show the department arguing for your side, perhaps even on your facts. In any negotiation, it's worth making sure that the department knows that you are aware of its contrary positions and that a victory in your appeal could cost them elsewhere. while the department's position in another set of facts may not, in another taxpayer's appeal may not necessarily be binding, it may have persuasive value in your negotiations or when framing your appeal. And the final lesson is that the final consideration that flows from these cases is to consider whether or not you have separate revenue streams or separate business units where you might be able to apply the operational approach to one revenue stream and the transactional approach to the other. We've seen this potentially applied in one ATB case, and from a negotiating perspective, having both options on the table can put the state in a particular bind when it tries to argue for one approach. That's all for now regarding pending cases, so let's turn it over to Mike for a look at the change to market sourcing in 2014.
Thanks, Rob. On July 24th, the Massachusetts House and Senate overrode a veto by Governor Patrick and enacted House Bill 3535. The legislation made some important sales tax changes, which we discussed in a separate teleseminar 2 weeks ago. A recording of that teleseminar can still be accessed on the Reed Smith website. The legislation also included some important changes to the corporate excise tax apportionment rules. These corporate excise tax changes will be effective for tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2014. So all the cost of performance issues that Rob just discussed will continue to be relevant for calendar year taxpayers for tax years through the end of 2013. In general, the new legislation replaces the all-or-nothing cost of performance sourcing rule with a series of specific rules for different classes of receipts. These new sourcing rules share one factor in common. They're all intended to source receipts to Massachusetts if the market for the sale is in Massachusetts. These new rules are set forth on the bottom of slide 8. Although these new sourcing rules are intended to remove a lot of the uncertainties surrounding the application of the cost of performance sourcing rule, they raise a number of new issues. I wanted to highlight just a few of the issues to watch under the new rules. First, the new sourcing rules may create opportunities for vendors of pre-written software. For example, consider a vendor that licenses pre-written software to its customers. The software is hosted on a remote server and accessed over the internet. Now, Massachusetts treats pre-written software as tangible personal property for apportionment purposes. As a consequence, under the new sourcing rule, the receipts from the license should be sourced to the location of the software, which presumably should be the server on which the software has been loaded. Thus, a vendor that's licensing pre-written software may be able to reduce its Massachusetts sales factor simply by making sure that the software is loaded on a server that's located outside of Massachusetts. A second issue to watch under the new sourcing rules is the uncertainty around the application of the rule for services. Under the new rules, receipts from services are supposed to be sourced to Massachusetts to the extent the services are delivered in Massachusetts. However, for many services, the location of delivery is going to be far from self-evident. Now, matters are simple when the service provider performs a service at the customer location. However, matters get much more complicated when the service provider performs a service in one location and the customer receives the benefit in a different one. For example, consider a brokerage firm that generates commissions from executing securities trades on the New York Stock Exchange for a customer that's located in Massachusetts. Are the firm's services delivered in New York, where the trades are executed, or in Massachusetts, where the benefit of the trades is received? Or should the commissions be sourced to a third location where the brokerage firm has its back office staff that actually execute the trade? For another example, consider credit card processing fees. Should the fees be sourced to the location where the credit card transaction is initiated by the cardholder, the customer's billing address, or the location where the credit card company's back office and processing operations are located? All three locations have a claim to be the location where the processing services were delivered. A third issue to watch under the new sourcing rules is the potential for distortion claims arising from the fact that the new rules will exclude a significant portion of total receipts from the sales factor for some taxpayers. Now, already before the new legislation, Massachusetts excluded interest and dividends from the sales factor. Now Massachusetts is also excluding most receipts from sales of intangible property from the sales factor as well. These exclusions have the potential to create a serious mismatch between the receipts included in the net income base and the receipts used to apportion that base. The resulting distortion may rise to a level that would violate due process clause under the U.S. Supreme Court holding in Hans Reis. One final issue to watch under the new sourcing rules is the impact that the rules will have on the existing special apportionment regulations for industries like telecom services, package delivery services, and the electricity industry. Under Massachusetts law, the department has the authority to adopt special apportionment regulations for an industry only if the standard apportionment formula is not reasonably expected to approximate the net income for that industry derived from activities in Massachusetts. Now, the legislature has made wholesale changes to the statutory apportionment regime, and we would expect that the existing industry-specific apportionment regulations will cease to be applicable unless and until the department determines that the statutory apportionment regime, including the new sourcing rules, does not reasonably approximate the industry's income from Massachusetts activities. For example, the department issued extensive apportionment regs for the telecom industry effective in 2009. Presumably, the department determined that the old statutory apportionment rules, including the cost of performance rule, did not reasonably approximate Massachusetts net income for corporations in the telecom industry. Now that the sourcing rules have been overhauled, we would argue that telecom industry apportionment regulations will cease to be effective for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2014, unless the department reissues the telecom regs based on a determination that the revised rules do not reasonably approximate the telecom industry's income from Massachusetts activity. Thus, going forward, telecom service providers may have the option of sourcing receipts from telecom services based on the delivery location under the new sourcing rules rather than under the 2009 telecom apportionment regulation. The new legislation also includes a throwout rule for certain receipts from sales other than sales of tangible personal property. Under this rule, receipts from sales other than tangible personal property are excluded from the numerator and denominator of the sales factor if either, one, the taxpayer is not taxable in the state to which the sale is assigned under the new rules, or two, the state to which the sale is assigned under the new rules cannot be determined or reasonably approximated. Obviously, Massachusetts has not learned anything from New Jersey's recent experience with throwout. In New Jersey, a similar throwout rule was the subject of numerous judicial and administrative challenges, and the rule was ultimately repealed. I think we can expect to see a lot of the same challenges arising in Massachusetts. First of all, the new Massachusetts throwout rule presents two key statutory interpretation issues. One, which state's rules will apply in determining whether a taxpayer is not taxable in a state to which a sale is assigned under the new sourcing rules? And two, what standards will apply in determining whether the state to which a sale is assigned cannot be determined or reasonably approximated? Turning to that first question, Reed Smith's view is that Massachusetts' own expansive nexus rules should be applied in determining whether a taxpayer is taxable in another state. Thus, if a credit card issuer has fee receipts that would be sourced to Pennsylvania under the new sourcing rules, those fee receipts should not be subject to throwout in Massachusetts as long as under Massachusetts' expansive concept of economic nexus, the credit card issuer would be taxable in Pennsylvania. Support for this view of how taxability should be determined for throwout purposes can actually be found in a recent appellate tax board decision in the first Marblehead case. As to the second statutory interpretation issue, there is uncertainty surrounding how the department intends to apply the portion of the rule that allows throughout of sales which cannot be assigned to a particular state under the new sourcing rules. Given the specificity of the rules, we would expect that this portion of the throughout rule should be interpreted narrowly. However, there is some risk that the department could try to apply this portion of the rule to throw out any sort of receipt that does not fit neatly into one of the categories, especially in the context of an out-of-state taxpayer. Taxpayers will need to keep a close watch on the department's guidance on the type of receipts that will be thrown out because they can't be assigned to a specific state under the new rules. In addition to these statutory interpretation rules, Massachusetts throughout rule also is likely to raise constitutional challenges. First, we would argue that the throwout rule is invalid on its face under both the due process and the commerce clauses of the U.S. Constitution. The throwout rule violates the due process clause because it produces an apportionment formula that is not rationally related to the tax base that's being apportioned. At the same time, the throwout rule also violates the commerce clause external consistency requirement because by design, it overapportions income to states in which the taxpayer is taxable, regardless of whether those states have any connection to how that income was generated. Second, many taxpayers will also be able to argue that the throwout rule is unconstitutional as applied to their specific facts, simply because the application of the rule will result in the apportionment of income to Massachusetts out of all proportion to the taxpayer's actual activities in Massachusetts. For taxpayers that derive a significant portion of their receipts from sales that would be thrown out under the new legislation, the resulting apportionment formula may be sufficiently distortive to raise constitutional challenges. With all these issues relating to throwout up in the air, I think it's safe to say that we can expect litigation over some or all of these issues once taxpayers begin filing returns for tax years covered by the new sourcing rules. That concludes our teleseminar on Massachusetts apportionment and sourcing issues. Please feel free to email us any questions or let us know if you need copies of any of the documents relating to the pending cost of performance cases or any of the department guidance that we referenced during the teleseminar. Thank you for joining us. Good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.